You know that goal you set at the start of the year? You can still do it, whether you're committed to a thru hike with friends, lifting heavier, or simply walking more. It's not too late to stick with it and make your future self proud, especially with the all-in-one nutrition shake from Ka'Chava. Because quality nutrition shouldn't be complicated. Just 2 scoops of Ka'Chava's all-in-one nutrition shake, and you've got 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, adaptogens, and so much more. Plus, it actually tastes delicious. No fillers, no nonsense. Just the good stuff your body craves. So instead of adding to your backstock of supplements that overpromise and underdeliver, simplify your progress with just 2 scoops of the highest quality ingredients. Stick with your wellness goals. Go to Ka'Chava.com and use code FITNESS for 15% off. That's Ka'Chava.com and use code FITNESS. K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com, code FITNESS.
What if the dead don't want to scare us? They just want to be acknowledged. Have you ever wondered if some hauntings are unfinished stories rather than threats? What would it mean to realize something followed you not out of malice, but desperation? Can spirits even ask for help? And if so, what happens if you're too afraid to listen? Can ignoring the paranormal be just as dangerous as confronting it? And what would you do if you realized the dead had been watching, quietly waiting for you to understand? These questions may not be answered today, but maybe through listening, you yourself may come up with a theory that comes pretty close. And if so, do share as we begin today's episode of The Dark Paranormal.
Live from Liverpool, The Dark Paranormal with Kevin Eustace.
Hello everyone, and welcome to our next installment of The Dark Paranormal. If you are new to the show, a big welcome and hello, and thank you for joining us here on The Dark Paranormal. And just in case the title didn't give too much away, we only focus on the darker aspects of paranormal experiences that people face. We don't do light paranormal tales here. Our aim is to keep you up at night. And that's solely both from an entertainment point of view and also from the point of view that if you accept that the light side of the paranormal exists, i.e. revisiting dead ones, etc., saying they're fine, then you have to, by default, accept that the dark side of the paranormal exists. And here on this show, we hear from some of the poor unfortunates who've had to deal with that very realm. If you are new to the show and you like what you hear, you can always send us your experience if you are one of those poor unfortunates by going to our show notes and finding the link, or you can go direct to thedarkparanormal.com and click on Submit My Experience. Also in the show notes, you'll find a link for a free trial to our Patreon at its highest tier. Now, I've said it before many times, but in my opinion, as someone who's done this for over 5 years and has been a paranormal fan all of my life, our Patreon is genuinely filled with some of the nicest people in the paranormal sphere you will meet. I have seen plenty and been a member of plenty of online internet forums regarding the paranormal, and there's always either a hierarchy or there are arguments. This Patreon is something that was built by the Patreons themselves, and that community never fails to amaze me each and every day. Believe me, if I were not the host, and I'm not just saying this, I would be a member of the Patreon, solely for that community. However, you also gain early ad-free access to all of our shows, and you can gain access to our back catalogue of Dark Bites episodes, which is our Patreon-only show that releases every single Sunday of the year, which is 30 minutes of the shorter experiences, which are still terrifying, but were a bit too short for the main show. And the back catalogue of that show, which is available now goes over 180 hours. That's over 180 hours of paranormal true tale that have never been heard by the general public. Again, the link for the free trial is in the show notes, or you can go to patreon.com/thedarkparanormal. And if right now Patreon is beyond your means, you can still support the show by leaving us a nice 5-star review. You could tell your friends about us. You could spread word about us online, about how good you find the show, or even by just subscribing to the show wherever you're listening right now, which you could do right now, and all of those things don't cost a single penny. But please know, anything that you do to support the show is both massively appreciated and a genuine help, so thank you. But right now, it's time. Lower those lights, make yourself comfortable, and most importantly, leave your disbelief at the door, as we hear all about the living frequency. The very first time I saw what I believe was a ghost, I was sat beside my father as he died. This was November 2003, and he'd been in the hospice for 11 days. The cancer started in his lungs and had moved to his bones, and by the end, the morphine was doing most of the work on keeping him present, if you could even call it that. He died just 2 weeks from his birthday. He would have been 59. 58 is an awfully young age to die these days. The hospice was a converted Victorian house on the outskirts of town in Lancashire. His room was on the ground floor, facing the garden. They'd tried to make it homely. Floral curtains, a wooden crucifix on the wall, because Dad had ticked Catholic on his admission form. But no amount of soft furnishings could mask that smell. That clinical sweetness of disinfectant layered over something heavier, which I would later learn is just what death smells like when it's taking its time. It was just over 2 in the morning when something changed. I'd been dozing in the chair beside his bed, and something woke me. Not a sound, but a shift in the room, like the air pressure dropped. The lamp on the side table cast a dim orange circle around the bedsheets. The rest of the room fell into a grey shadow. I looked at Dad first, thinking, maybe I'm picking up some sort of residual psychic message that this is his final time. And his breathing had changed. All evening it had been that awful rattle the nurses warned me about. But now it was barely there. Shallow sips of air, then long pauses, each one further apart than the last. I reached out for his hand, and it was cool to the touch. That's when I noticed the man standing at the foot of the bed. A tall man, broad-shouldered, wearing a dark green wax jacket and heavy work boots. Completely wrong for hospices at 2 in the morning. But the way he stood, feet planted wide, arms folded, chin slightly raised, was so familiar it made my throat close. Then he took a small step into the lamplight, and the room tilted. It was my grandfather, my father's father. The only trouble being he'd been dead 14 years. Though he looked exactly as I remembered. Mid-60s, a ruddy face, thick grey hair swept back, entirely solid. This wasn't a transparent figure, there was no glowing. He looked like a man who'd just walked in from the outside. He was wearing this wax jacket he was buried in, because Dad had insisted that his dad would have hated wearing a full suit. Granddad wasn't looking at me, he was looking at his son. And his expression was one I'd never seen on him in my life. Soft, patient, almost tender. He moved around to the opposite side of the bed and placed his hand over my father's, the hand I wasn't holding. Something in the room shifted again. The heaviness that had been building for days, and especially over the last few hours, stopped. My father's face, which I'd grown accustomed to seeing pinched and drawn through the morphine, through the pain, relaxed. The furrow between his eyebrows smoothed out for the first time in months. Grandad looked up at me, and his gaze was calm, steady. He gave me one slow nod. Not a greeting, not a pity nod. More a reassurance. And then he looked back down at his son. My dad took three more breaths, each quieter than the last, each after a longer pause. And on the third, he simply didn't take a fourth. I sat holding his hand as the warmth left. I finally looked up, and the space where Grandad had been was empty. The faint smell of engine oil remained. Grandad always smelt of engine oil from the lockup where he spent his life working on cars, motorbikes, but that soon faded. I choose to believe he came to walk his son out of this world. My next experience came in 2009, after I'd moved into a one-bedroom flat in Salford near Manchester. It was formerly a mill, red brick, high ceilings, arched windows. The building dated back to the 1840s, and you could feel the age in the walls. The way sound moved oddly through the corridors, the cold drafts that came from nowhere. Small things started within weeks. The kitchen tap running when I came home, not a drip, but full stream. Books would rearrange themselves on the shelves. Once, our water-damaged hymn book appeared between two of mine that I'd never seen before in my life. Then there were indentations on my bed. Not wrinkles, but the clear shape of someone who had been sitting on the edge of my mattress. So I bought a camera. I set it on the chest of drawers, angled at the bed, and I left it recording whilst I went to work. That evening, I watched 6 hours of nothing, until the clock in the corner of the screen shone the time 3:17 p.m. And I watched as the duvet slowly depressed into the shape of a figure sitting down. I noticed a short flicker just before this sitting down took place, but paid it no attention as I'm now watching an invisible person sat on my bed. It remained there for 11 minutes, and then gradually the bed rose up. I rewound the tape and found just before it formed, there was a brief flash of static that blew across the screen. Well, I didn't sleep well at all that night. The activity soon started escalating. I'd be in the kitchen and I'd see something move in my periphery. And I'd turn to witness the full opening of one of the cupboard doors. The TV would switch to static at odd hours. There'd be a persistent smell of old coal smoke appearing in the hallway, vanishing within minutes. One night, I awoke to hear the sound of what sounded like machinery, a rhythmic clanking like a loom from the empty flat below mine. I told my mate Chris, we'd known each other since school, and he's an electrician, he's pragmatic, no nonsense. The kind of bloke who'd strip a fuse box before entertaining the idea of a ghost. But he listened without laughing. He'd been to the flat several times, and even he'd mentioned it always felt heavy in here. Which, from Chris's point of view, was practically an admission of the supernatural. "Set the camera up again," he said, "but leave a candle lit on the table. I want to see if anything interacts with it." In hindsight, it was something I should never have done. But in all honesty, hearing him say these words, this skeptic, sounding like some ghost hunter from the TV, I think threw me into a state of semi-shock. And so I did. He asked me not to watch the footage until he was there, so I waited that night till he arrived and we watched the footage together. For 2 hours, the candle burned normally. Then that flash of static. Longer this time. 3 or 4 seconds. and when the image cleared, the flame was leaning hard to one side, as if something invisible was knelt down and slowly blowing a steady stream of air. And then it straightened. Then it blew the other way, staying in that position for a good 15 seconds. Both our mouths were left open as we continued to watch the screen. A few moments later, the candle itself moved. This was 3:11 p.m., according to the screen. It was still in its glass holder, and it slid 2 inches across the bedside table. Then again, then again, each time closer to the edge. And at 3:19, it went over, clearly out of sight of the camera, but you could see an orange glow start to grow and grow until the bedsheet itself caught fire. At this point, the camera stopped recording. We were both still open-mouthed. Chris looked at me as if to say, "And then what?" I looked at him and said, "What?" I don't have an answer for what just took place. He said, "But the fire, what happened?" I walked him to my room and shown him that my room was perfectly okay. The candle was on the bedside table and had burnt down in its wick. The unshakable Chris literally shivered in front of me and just said, "I'd get a priest if I were you." Now, we all have those friends, friends who sort of act as a father figure amongst your group. And when they say, "I would do this," you kind of treat them as the adult figure. And you think, "I should." So I did. So the very next day, I did. I called a priest. I made some brief excuse about being new to the area and wanting my house blessed. A young priest came round and he looked deeply uncomfortable the whole time he was there. He blessed every room with holy water, but he was gone within 20 minutes. For a few days, that flat felt lighter, which in turn made my mood lighter, which lasted about maybe 5 days, as I received the news that Chris had collapsed at a job site. Up a ladder rewiring a junction box, he simply went limp and fell, dead before the ambulance arrived. A massive stroke, 31 years old. He was fit as a fiddle. There were no warning signs. I was devastated. In the weeks that followed, the flat seemed to settle. The taps stayed off, the books didn't move, no more indentations. I genuinely joked with myself in a morbid way that I didn't know if it was staying quiet because of the priest or it was showing respect for Chris. I called a woman to arrange a more thorough cleansing of the flat just to make sure, ironically from a number Chris had given me. Some skeptic he was, God bless mate. She was a spiritual practitioner from Burnley. After a fortnight of calm, I cancelled, because whatever was wrong seemed to have genuinely passed. Months went by. I grieved Chris. I went to work. I came home to a quiet flat and felt something I hadn't in over a year. Normal, or at least semi-normal. I stopped checking rooms before entering. I stopped bracing myself every time I unlocked the front door. Although I didn't recall, I must have also put the camera away into the chest of drawers again to gather dust. It wasn't until just as I was packing up to move, because even with the piece, I couldn't stay in a place so tangled with Chris's memory, that I found it. The camera, still plugged in, still recording. I almost didn't look. And I genuinely wish I hadn't. Let's have a quick break to talk to you about Acorns. Acorns wants to show a little love to everyone who's on their way to some money goal. Now, a money goal may sound like something everyone has, but believe me, they don't. And even when you think you do, you don't really take into account the step-by-step incremental measurements that need to be made in order to achieve said goal. which is something I personally don't have the time to do. This is where Acorns do their magic, because they try to take you from where's my money today to that goal. And the way they do that is they focus on where your money is going to be tomorrow. There's two major things I want to point out with this. You don't need a bundle of cash to invest. You can invest your spare change. And the second thing is, I'm fortunate enough that the money I've invested, I've seen grow. And using the app, I can see that visually. They also have a potential screen. It shows you the power of compounding your money and how by doing so, you could grow it over time. Basically, for me, Acorns is an all-in-one. Invest, save, and give your money a chance to grow in one trusted place. Sign up now and Acorns will boost your new account with a $5 bonus investment. Join the over 40 million all-time customers who've already saved and invested over $27 billion with Acorns. Head to acorns.com/darkparanormal or download the Acorns app to get started. Paid non-client endorsement. Compensation provides incentive to positively promote Acorns. Tier 11 compensation provided. Potential subject to various factors such as customers' accounts, age, and investment settings. Does not include Acorns fees. Results do not predict or represent the performance of any Acorns portfolio. Investment results will vary. Investment involves risk. Acorns Advisors, LLC, and SEC registered investment advisor. View important disclosures at acorns.com/darkparanormal. This episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. A great job, married, dating, single. The truth is, most of us are still finding our way through this thing called life. And especially in February, the month of love, Valentine's Day, etc. If you're single, it can be a really rough time. Even if you're in a relationship, maybe things aren't going well. Maybe they're going too well, and that, in your mind, feels a bit off. But therapy can help you find what you want. What you want out of a relationship, out of a job, out of a career, out of a life. Now, I'm not ashamed to say in the slightest I've been in therapy for now over 2 years, and it's helped me immensely. Now, of course, I'm in the UK, but BetterHelp therapists work according to a strict code of conduct and are fully licensed in the US. They do the initial matching work for you so you can focus on your therapy goals. A quick questionnaire will identify your needs and preferences, and their 12 years plus of experience and industry-leading match fulfillment rate means they typically get it right first time every time. And if you're not happy with your match, switch to a different therapist at any time from their tailored recommendations. With over 30,000 therapists, BetterHelp is the world's largest online therapy platform, serving over 6 million people globally. And it works. With an average rating of 4.9 out of 5 for a live session based on over 1.7 million client reviews. So sign up and get 10% off at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com. I skimmed through weeks of footage on Fast Forward, expecting nothing. But it was all there, the duvet still depressing at odd hours. It had never stopped, not for a single day. I had just stopped being able to see it. The grief, the numbness, the exhaustion. Whatever had shut it down inside me after Chris died had shut down my ability to perceive what was happening around me. I'd spent months believing I was safe. The whole time, something had been sitting on my bed and watching me sleep, and I moved about that place as if in a daydream. I moved out the following week. I left that camera behind. Maybe 5 years later, around that time, something happened that made me think, perhaps everything on the other side isn't so malicious. It was autumn 2014, and I was driving home from a late shift. I'd come off the motorway and was heading down the dual carriageway when everything started to feel different. The streetlights looked warmer. The engine sounded softer. There was a calmness that settled over me unlike anything I'd experienced before. Deep. Absolute, like sinking into warm water. Then I heard my granddad's voice from the passenger seat. Ease off a bit, lad. I glanced over, and there he was. Wax jacket, ruddy face, grey hair, looking straight ahead through the windscreen as if giving driving directions from beyond the grave. As if this was perfectly natural. I lifted my foot from the accelerator. I was approaching a roundabout at the bottom of a hill.
Now start braking. Harder.
I pressed the brake hard. By the time I reached the roundabout, I was barely crawling. A car came from the right and blew straight through without slowing down, easily going 60 miles an hour in a 30 zone. It crossed my path so close, the displaced air rocked my car. Had I kept my normal speed, I'd have been directly in its path, without doubt. Instantly, that calmness vanished. Sound and anxiety flooded back and I gripped the wheel, my heart hammering. I looked to my left, Grandad was gone. I muttered, "Grandad, you've just saved my life." The seat was empty, but I could still smell that faint trace of engine oil. I'd like to say that's where my email ends, but my most terrifying experience is yet to come. And it came in 2016, in a place that had always felt safe. When Grandad died in 1989, nobody knew what to do with his lockup. It was a brick unit on a small industrial estate at the edge of town. He'd bought it in the early 70s and spent nearly every evening there, rebuilding motorbikes, restoring old cars. As a child, I'd sit on an upturned oil drum watching him work, breathing in that engine oil, listening to him explain compression ratios like I understood them. The industrial estate was built on the site of a Victorian cotton mill, one that had operated since the 1800s until its demolition in the late 60s. When Grandad passed, the lease passed to Dad, then to me after Dad died. I barely visited. What would I need it for? But selling it also felt wrong. In 2016, I decided maybe I could use it as a studio or something similar. So I finally went over to clear it out. It was a Saturday in October. Grey skies and dark by 4:30. I hadn't accounted for how long sorting all this out would take. There are no windows in these sorts of places, just the roller shutter and a strip light that buzzed when I flicked it on. I sighed at Grandad's workbench, still lined the back wall. Two rusted bike frames stood in a corner, and the air smelt of old oil and damp concrete. For 2 hours, I kind of just made my peace with it, walking round, flicking things, picking things up. And it was very peaceful. Just me, the radio, and decades of accumulated things. Old photos, receipts from the 70s, Grandad's driving gloves. Then the strip light started flickering violently. Not its usual dim buzz, but a rapid strobe that made the shadows lurch. I jumped up and hit the fitting with my palm. No change. Then it died completely. Total darkness. No windows, the roller shutter pulled mostly closed against the cold. I fumbled for my torch on my phone. And when the light came on, I realised I was no longer alone. There were three of them. Standing between me and the shutter were two men and one woman, dressed in clothes from another century. Collarless shirts, waistcoats, heavy wool. The woman wore a long skirt and a shawl. All had gaunt faces and hollow cheeks, exhausted in a way that went beyond tiredness. They looked like people ground by decades of brutal labour. They looked like they lived underground. I was paralysed. My phone shook so badly the light jittered across their faces. They were mumbling quietly amongst themselves in accents so thick, so old I could barely follow. They were not alarmed in the slightest by me, more mildly curious. The way you'd notice a piece of furniture had been rearranged. The man on the left in the flat cap turned to me. Long, lined face, eyes far too old for his body. "That can see us then." The woman stepped forward, almost hopeful.
"We worked here, all of us. This were mill."
The second man moved toward me, younger, thin-faced, dark hair plastered flat. His expression turned to something urgent. "I'm Samuel," he said.
Will they do something for us? There's folk as need to know.
His directness broke my paralysis. I ducked under the shutter, scraped my back on the metal, and I ran to my car. I drove home shaking so hard I could barely grip the wheel. When my partner asked what happened, I told him I'd had a panic attack. The darkness, the enclosed space, the emotion of Grandad's things, and they believed me. I wasn't ready to tell the truth. The truth being, I wasn't going back to that lockup ever. But Samuel, it seemed, wasn't finished with me. It started with small things. A framed photo of Grandad that I'd kept in the hallway. I'd find it turned to face the wall. The first time, I just turned it round and thought nothing of it. The second time, I felt a prickle across my scalp. The third time, I stood staring at it for a long, long time, my mouth dry, because I'd only left the room for 5 minutes. Then, that damp hymn book reappeared. I'd not taken it with me when I moved out of Salford. I knew that. Yet, there it was on my kitchen table as I walked downstairs at 5:45 for a morning coffee. Then followed dreams. The first was vague, a doorway, a woman's silhouette, the sound of children somewhere behind her. I remember waking up unsettled, but I wrote it off. But the second dream was clearer. The woman was young, mid-twenties. She wore a plain cotton dress and an apron. She was stood in the doorway of a small terraced house, as if she was waiting for someone. Behind her, I could hear three children. Not playing, but restless, fractious. The way children get when they're hungry or anxious or both. The third dream was the one that broke me. Same doorway, same woman, same children, crying. But this time, she was looking directly at me. And her face was of devastation and grief. The kind that's gone past tears and settled into something more permanent. She opened her mouth as if to speak, and I woke up gasping. My pillow was wet from sweat. My chest was aching with a sadness that I knew didn't belong to me. The dreams were every night after that. Always the same woman, the same doorway, always the same children, and each night her expression grew more desperate, as if she knew I could see her and couldn't understand why I wasn't helping. I couldn't take it anymore. I went back to the lockup that next morning, bringing with me my partner and my laptop. And whilst my partner loaded boxes into the van, I sat on Grandad's old stool and I searched. I searched for the mill's history, worker records, census data, accident reports. I found him within an hour. Samuel Hartley, born 1839, cotton spinner from the age of 12, died 1867, aged 28, after his arm was caught in a carding machine, bled to death on the factory floor. He was survived by a wife, Mary, and three young children. The eldest was 6, the youngest was 11 months old. There was even a photograph in the local history archive, a faded one which showed some thin, serious face. The same dark hair plastered flat, the same man who tried to speak to me in the darkness. Then I found Mary, a record in the parish archives, that noted both her marriage to Samuel, and then following Samuel's death with no income and no family nearby, she'd been forced into the workhouse with all three children within the year. The youngest, the 11-month-old, died in the workhouse before his second birthday. There was no record of what happened to Mary or the other two children after that. They simply vanished from the paperwork and from history. That's the way poor people did in the 19th century, as if they never existed at all. And I wonder if things have truly changed. I sat on that stool, overwhelmed by guilt. Samuel had asked me for help. He'd stood in front of me literally and started to tell me something. Something about people who needed to know something. And I'd ran. I'd chosen my fear over whatever he was trying to say.
and now I'd never know what that message was. Maybe it was something Mary needed to hear. Maybe it was something that would have given him or her peace, or even broken whatever thread was keeping him tethered to that patch of ground for over 150 years. I'll never know, and I have to carry that. However, the dream stopped after I found Mary's name. The hymn book, where I found it on my table, I placed in my bookshelf, where it remains. And since these incidents, the photograph of Grandad stopped turning. Whatever Samuel needed, the act of at least finding his family and giving them acknowledgement, seemed to have mattered, seemed to have been enough. Or at least to give him closure on something he'd been asking for. The above are just some of my major experiences, and there have been many, many more. But most are much smaller. The truth is, I've seen things and heard things since I was a child, and I've spent most of my life trying to tune it out, because it frightens me. Shadow figures at the edges of rooms, voices in empty spaces, people who appear for one moment and vanish when I look back. Sometimes they ask me to pass on messages, and I never do. The fear shuts me down every time. Except now I think about Samuel, and I wonder how many other messages I've refused to hear. How many other Marys are out there, waiting at doorways for words that will never come? And they'll never come because I was too afraid to listen. My daughters think I should embrace it. They call it a gift. One jokes I should get my own TV show. But they don't understand what it feels like to see someone who shouldn't be there and know they're looking back at you fully sentient. They don't know how frightening it can be. If I am a medium, and I believe I may be, I truly, truly don't want to be one. Maybe it does run in families. Maybe my granddad, covered in engine oil and holding spanners, fixing cars, listening to radios, surrounded his life with noisy machines and engines because the noise and oil and solid mechanics of reality kept the other stuff at bay. All I believe is that we're made of energy. And as we know, energy cannot be destroyed. Maybe when we die, it shifts to a different frequency. And maybe I'm just unlucky enough to be tuned in. Or maybe I'm losing my mind. I've not ruled that out either. Best, Thomas. Well, Thomas, and I know that's not your real name, thank you for one of the most amazing episodes I think I've ever read out. I knew this was going to be a good one when I took about maybe an hour to do the first 15 minutes. Simply because your excellent description of how somebody passes on in a hospice really resonated with me, having lost my dad a few years back. Now, do I believe you are a medium? Yes, 100%. And people could say, how could you be so sure? There is just something in how Thomas has wrote this email that makes me convinced he is indeed a medium. And it's up to him if he chooses to lean into or away from that gift. No pun on the candle meant. One thing I would say that I picked up before we end this amazing episode is, did you note in the Salford flat that you lived, you described machinery beneath you that you say sounded like a loom? And for those unaware, a loom was a type of spinning device that would have been used in mill factories. So it's kind of like, from my perspective at least, maybe Samuel was calling you long before you ever encountered him. I want to thank each and every one of you for joining me on today's Dark Paranormal. And don't forget, if you have your own experience, the link's in the show notes, as is our Patreon link too. So, until next time, remember, when you're discussing the paranormal, always leave some of your disbelief at the door. And I'll speak to you next time, right here on The Dark Paranormal.